Let's return to our study of the events of the day of Jesus' crucifixion. We are looking at the things that happened at the very end of the crucifixion. We know that Jesus was crucified mid-morning, let's just call it about 9 a.m., and that by midday, he's halfway through his crucifixion, and that's when the sun goes dark. And I believe you should picture it as the sun just goes dark and the stars suddenly appear in the sky. It's not an eclipse. It's not a cloud cover. It's just the most strange, weird, supernatural event that any of these folks had ever experienced in their lives. And so that's got everyone on edge. But Jesus doesn't talk, doesn't say hardly anything from the beginning of his crucifixion until right at the tail end of his crucifixion, after the 3 hours of darkness have been going on. And so we know Matthew 27, verse number 46, had already told us that around the ninth hour, so that's mid-afternoon, about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, Jesus cried out in a loud voice saying, "Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani." That is, my God, why have you forsaken me? And I spent some detailed time last session talking about how Psalm 22 picks all that up 1,000 years previous, and it's presented prophetically, a first-person account of Jesus' crucifixion there in Psalm 22. So Jesus calls this out in probably Hebrew, although some suspect it might have been in Aramaic. But we have assumed wrongly that Jesus would have been understood in this sudden call out by everyone standing there. I'm going to suggest to you that he has been very dehydrated. One of the things that Psalm 22 talks about is how the tongue on the inside of his mouth is swollen up, and it's actually sticking to the inside of the mouth. He is not going to be able to speak clearly at this stage in the crucifixion process. And again, he hasn't talked for several hours now. And the people there have kind of got used to the idea that he's not saying anything. And then suddenly he does, and he yells it out. And the only thing that comes across clearly enough for them is they hear the syllable El, which is God. They hear an E, which is my, on the end of that syllable. And then they've got that sound of a word that starts with an L. And so they hear in their head something different than what he actually said. And we know that because this is what it says, verse 47. Some of the bystanders hearing this call out said, "This man is calling for Elijah." Because in Hebrew, Elijah's name was Eliyahu. Eliyahu. And so perhaps what Jesus said suddenly sounded a little bit like calling upon the name of the great prophet who had disappeared in the whirlwind and the chariot many centuries earlier, which the Jewish people believed would be reversed right before the Messiah came. So some of these people apparently believed Jesus was calling for Elijah to come and take him off the cross and then present him to the world. So they decide that they're going to wait. Now, we'll get to that in just a moment. First, we need to bring something else in from another gospel. Matthew and Mark were telling us about Jesus calling out, "Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani," and the bystanders thinking that he was calling for Elijah. John, though, says this. This is chapter 19 of John, verse 28. After this, Jesus, knowing that all was now finished. So Jesus knows that he is about to die. We're right at the tail end of the crucifixion, mid-afternoon. He said, in order to fulfill Scripture, I thirst. So he says, audibly, I'm thirsty. And there was a jar full of sour wine standing there. So they put a sponge full of the sour wine on a hyssop branch and held it up to his mouth. So John reports that that was done in response to Jesus asking for a small drink of something liquid. Let's go back to the Matthew account, which parallels, by the way, the Mark 15 account. So Matthew 27, verse number 48 says, one of them at once ran and took a sponge, filled it with sour wine, and put it on a reed and gave it to him to drink. So that's the exact same event. So Jesus must have said, Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani, very loudly. And then the next thing that he said, very briefly after, maybe just seconds after that, I'm thirsty. And so this person grabs a stick, a hyssop branch or some sort of reed branch, puts the wine-soaked sponge on the end and holds it up to Jesus' mouth where Jesus can get a little slurp out of it. Verse 49, though, of the Matthew 27 says, but the other said, wait, let us see whether Eliyahu will come to save him. So that's all in just moments that this takes place. And they are thinking that they're going to wait to see whether or not Elijah shows up. Now, the Matthew and the Mark account both jump to Jesus' death next because it's so quick after that event. But John and Luke tell us there's a little bit more that takes place before his death. Let's continue with the John 19:30 passage. Very important. When Jesus had received the sour wine, so immediately after he got that little bit of out of the sponge, he then said, it is finished. Now, in the Greek language, this is the word tetelestai. And it is important to focus upon because that is the word or the abbreviation mark for this word that was placed on documents of debt whenever that debt was paid. So not only did Jesus say, it's done, the atonement is finished, he was also indicating that the debt had been paid. Aren't you thankful for that? That Jesus paid it all. So having said that, he has one more thing that he says that is recorded only in Luke 22. Luke 22:46. So all of these things happen in a matter of moments. Jesus calls out, Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani, I'm thirsty, it is finished. And then Luke 23:46, then Jesus calling out with a loud voice said, Father, into your hands I commit my spirit. And having said this, he breathed his last. Matthew 27, verse 50, Jesus cried out again with a loud voice and yielded up his spirit. Mark 15, 37, Jesus uttered a loud cry and breathed his last. And then, of course, the John 19, 30, part B, he bowed his head and gave up his spirit. So Jesus voluntarily ended his life at mid-afternoon, 3 o'clock in the afternoon, by the way we would think of it. He did not have his life taken from him. He gave it up freely, as he prophesied. No one takes my life from me. I lay it down of my own accord, and I have the authority to pick it back up again. So Jesus dies, apparently at the exact same moment that the incense offering was being placed on the prayer altar in front of the great veil that divided the holy place in front, where the priest did all their work, from the most holy place behind there, where the Ark of the Covenant used to be. It hasn't been the entire time this temple stood, but it's the place where God was thought to be. And this veil separated the holy God from a sinful humanity. And according to tradition, and I feel very strongly this is likely to be true, on the 14th day of the first Jewish month, because it was a special holy day, the day on which the Passover lambs were given, the high priest himself officiated during this prayer service. And so we can picture Caiaphas with all of his holy priestly garments on, you know, with the holy hat and the gold plate on the front of it that says holy to Yahweh, and the 12 stones on his chest and the great big stones on his shoulders. He is standing right there in front of the prayer altar when Jesus dies. And what is described as happening next? Matthew 27:51. And behold, the curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. That veil that we're talking about was very thick, had lots of folds in it, and it was kept in good repair. If it ever developed any type of problems, they'd take it down and work on it. But this thing rips from top to bottom in a moment's time, a huge rip. And we, of course, make the assumption, and I think appropriately so, there is no way in the world, by natural means, could this veil be torn except by God in that fashion, from top to bottom. Book of Hebrews describes this as being representative of removing that veil that separated us from God the Father, because our sin was the reason that veil was there. And Jesus took away the sin. Now, Matthew includes some other detail here that sometimes if you don't read it correctly, you'll get a misunderstanding of this. So let's make sure we focus on it. It says, and the earth shook and the rocks were split. So there was an earthquake that attended the death of Jesus Christ, which would have scared everybody again. I mean, it's dark. It's got an unnatural darkness for the last 3 hours. And then the moment Jesus cries out those last few words and dies, there is this earthquake that shakes the whole area. And inside the temple, the veil is ripped from top to bottom. And that can't be hidden. The word gets out on that everywhere. It's probably one of the reasons that the book of Acts reports that many priests came to faith in Jesus as the Messiah once the stories of his resurrection started being preached about. So that earthquake, mid-afternoon, 14th day, first month, that also split open some of the tombs in the local cemeteries. Verse 52, the tombs also were opened. So that popped open some of the tombs, but it's not until 3 days later, the day of the resurrection, that the next part of Matthew's story takes place. It says, and many of the bodies of the saints, that is, believers, who had fallen asleep were raised and coming out of the tombs after his resurrection. So let's make this clear. The tombs of select saints that had apparently recently died is the impression we get. Those tombs were popped open on the afternoon of the crucifixion. And then on the morning of the resurrection, those dead bodies were animated again. The spirits of those departed saints went back into those bodies, and then they walked out and they went into the holy city and appeared to many. So not only was Jesus' resurrection a testimony to God's power, but the resurrection of certain saints was testimony to God's power on the morning of Jesus' resurrection. Now, some people wonder whether or not those saints were permanently resurrected and went into glory with Jesus later. The text doesn't go on to say that. I'm going to offer my opinion, and that's all it's worth. I assume that this was simply a temporary being brought back to life, that all of these saints died again and will be resurrected on the great day of resurrection with everyone else that has passed away until the day of Jesus' return. Much like every person that Jesus ever resurrected from the dead, such as Lazarus, certainly died again and then would be resurrected later. Now, with all of that taking place in a short period of time, like the 3 hours of darkness, very important, Jesus yelling out very loudly certain phrases right there at the tail end of his life, and then the moment he dies, the earth rattles, and the temple veil is torn. Most people are not going to know about that till later. But this affects everybody that's standing nearby. These are supernatural events. And so we have the report of one particular guy that was a witness to the darkness, the death, the words before that death, and the rattling of the ground. And that's the centurion in particular, but also the watch that was there with him, the four soldiers. Matthew 27:54 reports, when the centurion and those who were with him keeping watch over Jesus saw the earthquake, so they felt it and they saw its effects right there, and what took place, that is, the darkness that had taken place for the last 3 hours, and the words of Jesus here in these last moments, it says they were filled with awe, and they said, truly, this was the Son of God. Now, I believe that we might be able to interpret this more generically than what many of our English Bibles intend to do. I'm looking at my English Standard Version here, and Son is capitalized just like God. And so they give the impression by that the centurion and the Roman soldiers now believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God. And I am not altogether certain of that. I will share with you why in just a moment. Mark 15:39 has the same testimony. When the centurion, so we're going to focus on him, who stood facing him, so he was watching Jesus when he died, when he saw that it is in this way that he breathed his last, he said, truly, this man was the Son of God. So same sort of thing the English Standard Version does, capitalizes S to represent a faith that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God. When we go over to Luke, though, we see something slightly different there. Luke 23:47. Now, when the centurion saw what had taken place, he praised God, saying, "Certainly this man was innocent." So slightly different take Luke presents here. Nothing about the divinity, the idea of the legitimate divinity of Jesus Christ, but the idea that he was innocent of the things that he'd been charged of. So I'm going to throw it out to you as this possibility. We know that the Roman peoples and the associated peoples within the Roman Empire, many of them were very religious, very superstitious, we would say. They believed in the supernatural, but they also believed that from time to time the gods would have relationships with humans and end up making little godlings, you know, demigods, half-gods, and that these were the heroes of old. They did great things. And so I'm going to suggest to you, I think the centurion was at least at this stage open to the idea that Jesus was someone very special, that in fact he was a son of a god, that he was a demigod, that he was something like, something like Hercules or someone like that. And that the people who had brought these charges against him were wrong in doing what they did to him, and that there was already clearly displeasure being shown by the gods through nature itself. Now, my hope is that people followed up with this centurion and hopefully with the four Roman soldiers, and that this initial openness to Jesus being someone special was followed up upon, and that they became true believers in Jesus as the Christ, the Son of the living God. But we're going to have to wait and see about that at some later date, whenever we're in the presence of God Almighty. Now, Luke 23, since we're already there, verse 48 reports this. All the crowds that had assembled for this spectacle, when they saw what had taken place, returned home beating their breasts. Now, if you watch funerals from the Middle East being broadcast, you will often see the participants pounding on their chest with their fist, or pounding on their chest over their heart with an open hand. This is the beating of the breast that was being described here in this passage. It is a physical expression of great grief. So the folks that were there watching Jesus die, once he was dead, went away grieving. It says all his acquaintances and the women who had followed him from Galilee stood at a distance watching these things. Matthew 27, starting at verse 55, gives more specificity than that. It says there were also many women there looking on from a distance who had followed Jesus from Galilee ministering to him, among whom were Mary Magdalene, and she's going to be part of the resurrection story soon, Mary, the mother of James and Joseph. Now, I believe that's Mary, the mother of Jesus, because we know that Jesus had two brothers named James and Joseph. And so I think this is the way Matthew identifies Mary, the mother of Jesus. And then the mother of the sons of Zebedee. That would be the sister of Mary. So that would also tie us together in the order here. This would be Salome, the mother also of James and John. Mark pretty much says the same sorts of things. Mark 15:40. There were also women looking on from a distance, among whom were Mary Magdalene and Mary, the mother of James the Less, or James the Younger, and Joses, which is just another form of Joseph. So that's Mary, the mother of Jesus, I think. And Salome, that would be the wife of Zebedee, the mother of James and John. When he was in Galilee, they followed him, ministered to him, and there were also many other women who had come up with him to Jerusalem. So these are the ladies that have been following him for a very long time, ministering first up in Galilee, and then when Jesus had come to Jerusalem on this particular occasion, they came with him. John chapter 19. This is where we'll wrap up today and kind of set up for tomorrow's session. John chapter 19, verse 31. Since it was the day of preparation, that's the usual name for Friday in the Greek language here. So it's the day of preparation, the day before the Sabbath. And so, since it was the day of preparation, and so that the bodies would not remain on the cross on the Sabbath, for that Sabbath was a high day. Now keep in mind, most crucifixions could go on for several days because the human body can survive crucifixion for several days. But because this day is right before a special Sabbath, that is the Sabbath of Passover week, Pilate is going to make an accommodation to the Jewish people. So the Jews asked Pilate that their legs might be broken and that they might be taken away. And so the soldiers came and they broke the legs of the first and the other who had been crucified with him. So this is a speeding up process. The moment you break those shin bones, the criminal cannot push up on the nail anymore and pull in another breath. And so very quickly, they fail in being able to continue breathing.